how much was the idea of the ruling class? You know, you said about putting standbacks on and trying to impress the person at that time, when they were trying to fill the job to see if they succeeded. How much of those ideas was based on their own class consciousness and looking at the revolutions that preceded in France? How much were they really worried that the revolution was a real fear?
I think they were mainly worried about the idea of a French revolution type situation, and they studied it very carefully. There were numerous works published in Britain in the 1790s, for example, against the French Revolution and the democratic ideas which existed at that time in France. To take one example, Edmund Burke had for many years been the leading spokesman for parliamentary reform, because Burke argued that there should be a reform of Parliament allowing more seats to be given to the smaller aristocracy. Burke was in fact the kind of representative of a group within the 18th century British ruling class, a minority group known as the Rockingham Whigs, who were attempting to get into some kind of power in British society. What happened was the French Revolution caused Burke to completely change his thinking, and this happened with most of these moderate reformers. As soon as they were, and because Burke wrote his famous work, Reflections on the French Revolution, and many other moderate reformers went right away from reform because they thought if reform was going to lead to something like that, they didn't want it. And you've got to realise there was some understandable reason for it, because even though in 1789, the French Revolution seemed like a good idea. It seemed, you know, in the same way as in 1917, the Russian Revolution seemed to many radically minded people like a good idea. Just like the Russian Revolution turned into a very nasty and brutal revolution within a very short time, by the early 1790s, the French Revolution had turned into the dictatorial rule of the Jacobin and the control of society by tyranny. And there were many people who said that's what happens with reform. Meddle with the state of affairs and you end up with who knows what. And they really did think that. And they also really did think that it was wrong to allow the working class into power. One of them argued, that spoke to George Pitt, wrote a pamphlet saying, look, if you give the working class the vote, they won't know what to do with it, and they'll be open to bribery by different factions of the capitalist class, which in fact is what has happened. Because since the working class has got the vote, capitalists have had to spend millions and millions of pounds bribing workers to vote for one capitalist faction against another. And you can understand that point of view. But by and large, it must be said that many workers themselves were opposed to any kind of major change. So, yes, there was to a great extent a degree of class consciousness. The Stamp Act was certainly a class conscious act. The anti-combination laws, which banned trade unions until 1825, was certainly a class conscious act.
Why was that sort of initiative that Stamp was obviously in so many people actually assembling and kind of keeping them? That sort of initiative which had been building up through the 1840s and before that. How was that dissipated? You said before that in between the 1848, 1852, and until the end of the 1870s, there was a big lull. I mean, how was that redirected, rechanneled at that time?
There were two things. One was that it was simply done by brute strength on the capitalist class. In other words, it was done by intimidation. By the end of the 1840s, the average worker knew that if he protested, he would likely get his head smashed in. And you know, that's like somebody in years to come is going to say, how did the blacks in South Africa sit back for so long and allow this to carry on? Similar to what they were scared. Secondly, Engels' point, a very important one. The capitalist class began to learn the trick of bribing workers. They began to learn it's actually cheaper to give concessions in the form of reform, rather than to have armies on every street corner. After all, for example, you know, I was talking about the Newport Rising. Somebody wrote a research paper which I read some time ago. I don't actually agree with it, but it might be true. And he was arguing that the whole of the Newport Rising was actually started up by government spies. And the whole Chartist movement was dominated by spies, by needs to use government intelligence services to prevent workers from doing it. And the ruling class learned that reform was the answer. Reform kept the workers quiet. In the words of Engels, they bought an armistice. The third, where did it go? In terms of the kind of workers who tended to dominate Chartism, who were the skilled working class, it tended to go into the new model unions, what are called the new model unions, which started up in the 1850s, which were organisations like the Amalgamated Society of Engineers, who were very respectable, anti-strike. They didn't talk in terms of class, and it wasn't until, in fact, the end of the 1880s, but it happened a bit sooner than that, that you started to get non-skilled workers forming unions, the beginning of what was called the new unionism. And the thing about it is that one of the important things to understand about the 19th century is, of course, there was a constant change in class composition in terms of the working class. In other words, in the 1830s, there were very, very few people who were working in the kind of large-scale factory production which existed by the 1870s. So it was a change in the composition of the working class and where workers were and how they were living, which also affected things. But another important thing was in 1870, it became compulsory for workers to go to school, and working class children to go to school and have some form of elementary education. And the majority of them after 1870 started to do that. So that by the 1890s, you started to have a number of people around the age of 20 who could read and write. And because in the period of Chartism, that existed far less. Class struggle isn't a static thing. The class struggle always goes on whether workers and capitalists want it to or not. But the class struggle changes its form all the time. There's a constant, sometimes it intensifies, sometimes it's far less. And the 1830s was an intense period of class struggle. The 1850s and the 1860s was undoubtedly not that. And, you know, it seems to me that those rather silly and to some extent dishonest historians who claim to be Marxists who argue that the late 1860s was a big period of working class militancy because the First International existed, that strikes me as to be completely incorrect, because in fact the majority of British workers who had anything to do with the First International were opposed to the ideas of Marx anyway, and they themselves constituted a very small minority of the working class anyway. But that's sidetracking. The fact of the matter is it was diverted into new model unionism, support for reforms, support for the Liberal Party, and of course after 1867 support for the vote was given to many workers. After 1867 the vote was given to many workers in a great tactic by Disraeli. He decided to beat the Liberals at their own game and give the workers the vote. And in one of the very rare, one of the unique occasions of justice for the working class in history, or justice to the ruling class in history, what actually happened was that the workers, having been given the vote by this great political manoeuvre by Disraeli and the Tories, they used the vote to get rid of Disraeli and let the Liberals. And that served him right.
Steve, I noted that in the talks you did mention, you did want the left wing and other agitators to take example from the new party resolution, something like that. May I ask, what other means will John Frost have used to achieve his aim at the time?
Well, I think Bronte O'Brien's right. What I think John Frost and other workers who wanted some kind of democracy should have done was to have simply used trade union power. This has always been the Marxist position. It's certainly the position which I think is the only reasonable one you can put to. If you take workers in Russia, let's not talk about past, let's talk about now. Take workers in Russia or workers in Chile or workers wherever they may be, where they are in a position where they simply cannot have access to the state. There are no free elections, you can't organise meetings like this. The only answer has to be to use the strength you've got in the trade unions to say, and this is one, it's the only last final answer that the working class has got when it comes to a real test of power, to simply say, if you do not give us that degree of freedom, we will not work. And of course, That is the answer which this party put to workers in Eastern Europe for many years. And of course, when it happened in a few years ago that workers in Poland, to some extent, and there are all sorts of criticisms one might make of the Solidarity trade union, but to some extent, that's what they did. They said, look, it's no good organising in little political groups opposing the government and getting shot down for it. If you organise a trade union, you hit them where it hurts. It's the one thing they need the working class for, it is to produce the golden egg of profit. And if you stop laying the golden egg, they can't just shoot, you know, they can't shoot you. They've got to do something about it. And that's what Bronte O'Brien's answer was, and that's what I would agree with. The problem with what John Frost did is exactly the same as anyone. It would be like, it's very easy. I remember during that period, what, a year, 2 years ago, when Solidarity was existing in Poland, there are all sorts of people, brave people, it's easy to be brave when you're a long way away from the action, saying what you should do is take on the trade union members, you know, take on the state. All you get is broken heads. All you get is the state using the most terrible repression to stop that happening. Because if the state has got the arms, there's nothing you can do as a minority to take it on. There's nothing you can do as a majority to oppose the state even, as long as you leave the power of armed force in the hands of the state. And that, of course, is a terribly tragic lesson which the workers of Newport learned. And it's a lesson which I'm afraid other workers today are going to learn. Workers who talk a lot about the need for minority violent revolution, they're simply going to learn that the only lesson of that will be broken heads and martyrs. So Frost should have walked towards the trade unions. That was the answer then, and that is the answer now in areas where workers have not got the opportunity to oppose, to have any kind of access to a capitalist state.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, it seems that this early wave of early socialist thought in the 1830s and afterwards, not only did you say it was partly inspired by the French Revolution, or within the French Revolution, would there be any sense in suggesting that that the enthusiasm and the positive nature of this early wave was inspired partly by the fact that capitalism itself was a much younger system, had not been as firmly entrenched and established as it is perhaps now? And in that sense, that they had that advantage then, in one respect, compared with us now, that they were dealing with a system which, after all, the French Revolution itself was a capitalist revolution, had taken place only, 40 years before some of the publications you were quoting were published. And consequently, if that's taken as perhaps as marking the beginning of modern capitalism in France, at least, they were criticising a system which was fairly recently established. And also, on a similar note, I've heard of the slogan of abolish the wages system. Not, in fact, having been coined first by Marx later on in the century, but I think I've heard of this slogan being used even earlier on by workers. Some possibly saying it's in a sort of reactionary sense. They didn't like the new capitalist wages system, and in fact, in some cases, possibly even wanted to go back to something which had existed before the wages system was developed earlier on. But is there any sense in that analysis?
Yeah, well, there's probably some sense. Your first point is probably correct, that because capitalism was a newer system, workers, as you say, were, in that sense, they thought it might be something that wouldn't last as long. You know, if they knew then, we'd still be sitting here now agreeing with the things that they were saying then. You know, they'd have felt as depressed then as we feel now. So that's just one of those things. History has, in fact, not worked out the way that they thought it would. But that's a good point. On the point about wage slavery, it's quite true. The whole idea of wage slavery was originally coined as a concept to oppose the idea of not being the breakdown of the old rural peasant community. And that's quite true. But I'll tell you something interesting, and I don't know whether the particular standard is at the back, and I wouldn't read it to advertisement articles which I've written, but there is... all proceeds go to the party, so it's okay. There was actually an article which I wrote about 6 months ago, or a year ago, which was dealing with a correspondence in that journal which I've got here, called The Red Republican. And in that journal, incidentally, Harney was a man who published The Red Republican between 1850 and 1851, and he changed the name of the journal after 1851 to The Friend of the People. and Harley would allow anyone to write for it. Well, that sounds like a good thing. But Marx, who was a little bit intolerant about this sort of thing, he didn't like the idea of Harley allowing everyone to write for the Red Republican. There are articles in it by Mazzini, by various French revolutionaries and so on. And in fact, Marx nicknamed Harney Comrade Hip Hip Hooray, because Harney would cheer at every demand any worker made anywhere. As long as it sounded radical, Harney would appear to be supporting it, and Marx gave him this nickname. But there was a correspondence, which I discovered one day when I was sitting in front of the bound volumes of the Red Republican, looking nothing better to do with my time than look through it. I noticed a correspondence sent in by a man called George Smith, and the heading was Abolition of Money. And he, in fact, wrote this article, this letter rather, to the Red Republican, saying radical reform is a good idea. What we ought to do, in fact, is to abolish money. And this caused a whole series of letters in reply. I think there were about 8 or 10 of them in all. They're all referred to in that article which I wrote. And it was a very interesting example of how, in the early days of capitalism, some of the features of capitalism, which we've now grown to believe are inevitable, or we haven't, but most workers have, like the existence of money and the existence of wages and the existence of governments and so on, in those days they were being questioned and thought about. And as I say, that I don't remember which socialist standard that article is in, but I did write something up on it.
In your talk, I noted that you criticised Edmund Burke, you know, the parliamentary, to some extent. You did say that he was a defender of the capitalist system. As I've quoted, I think I've read some way that actually Burke wasn't concerned with capitalism as such, but social reform, things like rule of law, human rights. Was it not Burke not right when he said that if power were to be given to the working class, a certain amount of anarchy would be sent to society? But I read from the history. Was it not right if the power were given to the workers of the state, as in those times was talking about? Should we not see a very popular issue today in the labor movement of our age? We do a different thing from this popular institution.
Yeah, it's an interesting. You remind me, as you were saying that, of something that Quinton Hogg once said when he became Lord Powlsham. He made a point which has got a sort of a germ of truth in it. He said, in the 19th century, when the working class didn't have the vote, you had far more tolerance towards workers and social reform enacted by the ruling class than you've had since workers have had the vote and they've had the opportunity to vote their own oppressors into power. And to some extent, there's a certain kind of truth in that, that you can almost say that workers have, to some extent, created a system of oppression which is even worse in some ways than that which was simply imposed from above. However, that's not entirely a serious reply. The real reply to that is, of course, anarchy is a relative conception. I think, of course, that everybody having enough food to eat is not a system of anarchy. But, of course, if you ask a policeman or a soldier guarding the large mountains of food in somewhere like India or Bangladesh, he would consider it a state of terrible anarchy if the workers and peasants broke through the lines and the barriers and started taking the food for themselves. So, of course, when it comes to it, Burke's conception of anarchy, from his particular class standpoint, was a correct conception of anarchy. What I would argue is that, in fact, and this raises another point, and it's a very important point for socialists, that we are not talking about the rule of the mob. Socialism doesn't mean the rule of an uneducated, politically ignorant majority, because an uneducated, politically ignorant majority are not going to be able to run society in a fashion that's going to be in anyone's interest. We're talking about the rule of conscious, determined, aware people who know what society is all about. They know that you've got serious jobs to do in society. You've got to create food for people to eat and clothing to wear and shelter. And therefore, you're right in one sense that had the working class simply been told, here is power on a plate, you're in charge, there would have been a degree of anarchy, because socialism presupposes a level of consciousness which allows those who are going to inherit the control of ownership over society to use that wisely. And that, of course, is what we're after. In that sense, of course, Burke had a point. But I think you're wrong, in fact, in what you say about Burke being interested not primarily in capitalism, but in the rule of law and so on. He was interested in that, but Burke was a very, very devoted supporter of the private property of the class which he represented, and which, incidentally, he was paid by. Burke was not a man of very large private means. Burke was, in fact, employed to put forward the views that he did by a particular group within the Whig Party, which was dominated by the Earl of Rockingham. And in fact, most of Burke's early writings were simply, fairly irrelevant to the present day. They were manifestos for the Rockingham Whigs. In other words, in 1770, I don't know whether you particularly want a brief lecture on 18th century history, but during the first, the early years of the 18th century, the Whig group led by the Duke of Newcastle was in control. And for a brief period after 1760, when George III became the king, he threw out the Newcastle Whigs and he appointed a new controller over the state, a man called the Earl of Bute. And for 10 years, the Newcastle Whigs were out of control. They didn't have access to the state. And this so incensed the Newcastle Whigs and their the younger group within them, the Rockinghams, that they argued that there was a state of anarchy and that everything was going wrong and the state was about to crumble. And as a result, in 1770, they got Burke to write a book called On the Present Discontents, in which he argued in absolutely historically incorrect terms that the years between 1760 and 1770, when the Newcastle Whigs weren't in control, were years of anarchy and chaos and terrible times for Britain. In fact, Burke was very largely the representative of a particular section of the working of the ruling class, and was one of the most. It's not a coincidence, incidentally, that there is a Tory Party central office booklet which is called The Case for Conservatism. And in that, it says every Conservative ought to read the works of Edmund Burke at least once every 2 years. I once quoted this in a debate, incidentally, against a young Conservative, and I said, even, you know, we're accused of being dogmatists reading away at Marx. Even, you know, our head office doesn't send out instructions saying you've got to read the works of Karl Marx every 2 years. But it says you've got to read the works of Burke every 2 years. And if there is one person who is admired by the modern Conservative Party, it's Edmund Burke. In fact, again, I once mentioned to a Conservative opponent in a debate that Margaret Thatcher was, in one sense, the Burke of the 20th century.
You started off your talk earlier by explaining how the ruling class, in order to defend their property, have to try to prevent those who do not have any property from having access to the state. In other words, that property and democracy are ultimately incompatible. And yet we ended up with the point that in 1867 the vote was granted by Disraeli to many workers. Obviously, this did not lead, in fact, to property being abolished, and hasn't done it yet since then. Although you could explain this simply in terms of the fact that the working class hasn't yet developed the consciousness to do that, I do wonder about the sort of reasons, the motivation coming from Disraeli, for example, in doing that. If the vote was granted to these workers, was it simply a lack of foresight, ultimately, on the part of the capitalist class, that they granted the vote despite the point that you opened your talk with?
Yeah, I think it was foresight. I think it's simply a question you can't hold things back forever. I mean, it's exactly the same reason why at the beginning, in the 1880s, there was a major, we're going to go on to that next week, but there was a major development of socialist ideas in Britain, or semi-socialist ideas in Britain, you might say. And as a result of that, it became the fashion towards the beginning of the 20th century for many capitalist reformers to call themselves socialists. There's something about political vocabulary that sometimes, the thing to do is you say, well, look, I don't actually like the idea, but I'll accept the label because it's a fashionable one. You know, I don't actually, you get this, you know, you've seen Liberal Party conferences, haven't you? And they say, you know, we don't actually like the idea of socialism, we don't even know what it is, but, you know, we'll use a term, we'll call ourselves socialists of sorts or whatever. It's a thing if a term becomes fashionable. And it's exactly the same. There was a group in the, there was one in the 1820s, but a more important one in the 1860s, who were known as the Tory Democrats. And the Tory Democrats simply argued, you've got at a certain point to give way. One of the most striking examples of this that I know of, I think it was in 1834, but somebody can correct me if I'm... No, I am wrong. I thought it was in 1834, where there was a document issued called the Tamworth Manifesto. It was in 1834 by Robert Peel, and who was later to become the Tory Prime Minister. And Peel argued in the Tamworth Manifesto, the time of Tories simply refusing to accept reforms, the Tory party being a party of reaction and anti-democracy, this isn't going to work anymore. And the Tamworth Manifesto said, from now onwards, the Tory party, or the Conservative party as it became known after that, is a party of reform. It's a party that accepts change. It's not going to happen. And if Edmund Burke wrote about this, Edmund Burke, in a famous passage in his Reflections on the French Revolution, said, you know, I paraphrase it, change is okay as long as it happens slowly and as long as it doesn't do too much damage to the basic institutions of society. Let it occur slowly. And if you're an enlightened capitalist politician or a capitalist, that's the way to think. After all, it's a silly capitalist like George Ward at Grunwick who don't let trade unions be set up. It's a silly capitalist who comes out in the open and says workers should not have the vote. It's a silly capitalist like the man, the MP for wherever it was, who I was hearing about on the radio yesterday, who made a statement saying that most workers on the dole are spending their money in pubs and they're fiddling the state and they could get jobs if they wanted them. People don't say that anymore. They're sensible. The sensible Tory, the sensible Labourite, is a compassionate man. The Jim Pryors and the Roy Hattersleys, the people who kind of smile at you while they stick the knife in your back. That's the way capitalism has to work. And that's what the Tory party recognised. And of course, you know, in a sense, the argument was, why hold them at the end of the barrel of a gun if you can get them to vote for their own oppression? After all, you know, if you can get them to do it themselves, if you don't need to force them, why pay for a dictatorship when you can get the workers to do it themselves? And that happened. The problem with that, and I don't want to go into this too much because it's covering ground which is a completely different subject and a more contentious one, but the problem with that is that when it comes to a capitalist crisis, I personally, and I'm not expressing necessarily a view of the Socialist Party here, but I personally don't think the capitalist class can maintain that policy. It's my view that what happens when you have a long capitalist crisis, possibly like the one we're in now, the capitalist class simply cannot pay for that kind of liberal democracy. And my argument, although I don't want to cause a debate about it now, is that what happens in those situations, and what probably will happen in this situation, is that the capitalist class simply pull back on that and don't even maintain the pretense of democracy.
Can I just come back on one or two points there? Do you mind? Just two brief points following on from that. One thing is when you say that it was a question of giving in at some point and so on. The odd thing about that thing is that in 1867, when the vote was granted, Chartist agitation had died out about 20 years earlier. And could I just add a second question to that, which comes out of what you said? When you say that in times of capitalist crisis, the capitalist class can't afford to pay for that, earlier on you were saying that the using armed force to suppress discontent and repression, you had said earlier on that they found that it was in fact cheaper to run an artificially supposedly democratic system than it is to pay for the repression.
Well, I'm interested in sticking primarily to the historical points I was making. On the second one, the simple answer I would give to you there is that during the period of crisis, working class discontent becomes such, this is my main point, I think working class discontent becomes such that it in fact probably becomes cheaper to start thinking in dictatorial fascistic terms than in democratic terms. That's a point of contention, as I say, which even within the Socialist Party there can be arguments about. Some people, and you know, people who are good socialists, have said to me that's an alarmist attitude, an incorrect attitude. It's one which I very firmly hold, but it doesn't, because it's one of those arguments which you can call a predictive one, in other words, talking about what is likely to happen, I hope I'm wrong. What I would say about the other point you made is that no, that's not what happened, because in the late 1860s you began to have the growth of a movement of trades councils in Britain. And I would argue that had a very important effect. But no, the main division that occurred, I think, in the 1860s was that you began to have a competition between the liberals and the conservatives over who could offer the most appealing reforms. And I think that the argument was that the best way to find out what the working class thought was to test it through the ballot box. I mean, this is our argument as a Socialist Party, that the best barometer of working class consciousness is the ballot box. And of course, this is what the capitalist class thought themselves, and they still do to a great extent. That's why, in the early 1970s, when the capitalist class were divided amongst themselves in Britain over whether or not to join the common market, their argument was, throw it out to the working class, let the working class fight over it and make the decisions. To a great extent, this is a very easy way of finding a kind of an independent arbiter about capitalist problems. Workers are allowed to fight it out between themselves. And in a sense, what happens is that, you know, in the various pressure groups amongst workers about which section of the capitalist class should have greater control, it's the workers' heads who get broken. The capitalists are well away from the political scene, not engaging in the debate very often. You know, the argument about should the Falklands War have been fought or should it not have been fought? It was workers who very largely were the ones who were passionately involved in that, far more than many capitalists were. In fact, I would argue, again, it's an independent point of view, but I would argue that the British capitalist class might quite willingly, had it not been for political considerations of what workers would do, simply let the Argentine junta have the Falklands. I think that to a great extent, they weren't looking after their own independent capitalist concern. I think that it was the patriotism and nationalism of workers which was the greater political problem. That's not the only reason. In fact, there's there were important economic reasons why the capitalist class took part in the Falklands War, I should add. In fact, there's a very good article in the Standard about it.
You mentioned Ricardo's labour theory of value. Mm. How much did that influence the capitalists over towards reforms? Because I had this Open University program where, you know, they were re-doing sort of Ricardo's talks. Mm. And he seemed to speak about the labour theory of value, that it is, you know, you say that it's the workers that produce all the value. Mm. And a country should look after its workforce enough. So how much did that labour theory of value
The answer to that is that the early perception of the labour theory of value was that the labour theory of value was not an explanation of how things were, but how it should be. In other words, it was a moral statement. Marx, of course, was simply saying workers are exploited, workers do produce surplus value, the capitalists take that surplus value in the form of rent, interest and profit. The early Ricardian so-called socialist people, who in fact were very often associated with the political ideas of Bentham and Mill and the utilitarians, they were arguing that the labour theory of value was a theory of what workers ought to have, that workers should have the full fruits of their labour. Many of them also used the ideas of John Locke, because John Locke argued that the product of labour should naturally belong to the person who produced it. That was, of course, the idea of the early 17th century rising capitalist class, who, because they were very often entrepreneurs, that was a very good class ideology for them, that they should have what belonged to them, and they shouldn't have to give it to the aristocratic state. Later on, it was turned against them, as ideologies invariably are. So that was one of the things about that. It was seen as a moral statement, and pamphlets like Labour Rewarded took the Ricardian idea as a statement of how distribution should take place. But this is the other point. Most pre-Marxist political economy of the post-Ricardian period was a political economy of distribution. So they always saw things as a problem of distribution, not a problem of production. It wasn't until Marx that the problem not of how goods were circulated, but who owned the means of producing them, became the real problem. And of course that's something which these early radicals didn't entirely understand. I'm just reminded of a quick anecdote, incidentally, that somebody who was a very able member of this party, only knew him shortly before he died, Gilbert McClatchy, or maybe to write Gilmack in the Standard, who wrote that pamphlet on historical materialism. He, in his early days, wanted to become an accountant. And he was going past a second-hand bookstore, and he saw these books on display, and he saw a book called Capital, study of capitalist political economy. He picked it up by Karl Marx, bought three volumes of it, took it home, read volume one, read volume two, halfway through volume three, and he turned to the person sitting next to him and said, Christ, you have to know a lot to become an accountant. Of course, when it comes to it, a lot of people have actually thought of things that way. There are even people in the Labour Party today who actually think that what Marx was talking about was giving workers a surplus labour back. That, of course, wasn't the argument. Incidentally, just one final anecdote on that point while I'm at it. There was one person who, when the 10-hour day was being argued for, as you know, Marx's labour theory of value was that, explained in simple terms, if there's a 12-hour day, the last 2 hours were the hours in which the surplus labour was given free of charge in the form of profit. And when the 10-hour day was being argued for, this man said, if the capitalists don't get the extra 2 hours, they won't get their surplus value.